This show proudly sponsored by Real American Freestyle Wrestling. Real American Freestyle is the first ever unscripted pro wrestling league created by Hulk Hogan, Chad Bronstein, Israel Martinez, and Eric Bischoff to give elite wrestlers a real shot at professional career. Real American Freestyle is where Olympians, world champions, and NCAA legends come to compete. Not in a cage, not in a script, but on the mat in front of fans around the world. This is real wrestling, reimagined for today. The first event kicks off August 30th in Cleveland, featuring matchups with some of the best wrestlers on the planet. You've never seen wrestling like this. Learn more at realamericanfreestyle.com.
Fox News headquarters in New York City. Always seeking solutions, never sowing division. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. So glad you're here. The Brian Kilmeade Show coming your direction. A lot going on, a lot of balls in the air today. And, you know, of course, any minute, supposed to hear the latest from what's happening over in Egypt. Today, Pam Bondi is going to be testifying in front of the Senate Judiciary Committee. She's going to be talking about everything from what's going on with the National Guard in the Blue Cities to James Comey and the Epstein files. I'm sure every Democrat's going to want to talk about that until, of course, they really get into it and they realize how many Democrats are involved in that. But we digress. Senator Bill Cassidy is standing by. Jackie Heinrich at the bottom of the hour. So now let's get to the big three.
Number three.
This is what you said at the time about that particular shutdown. Here it is.
We are willing to take what Senate Republicans have done in order to reopen the government so that we no longer are holding 800,000 federal workers hostage.
Well, that's exactly what you're doing right now.
Yes, that was on the Today Show. Another failed attempt to end the shutdown as the Senate remains five votes shy of opening up the government. And now air travel becomes the first public service that I could see showing signs of stress and inconvenience for us.
Number two.
The right wing in this country wants a rematch of the Civil War. I want that to sit in right now because the President of the United States of America has declared war on the people of Chicago.
That is one of the most irresponsible things you will ever hear, but I should expect it from the mayor of Chicago. Ice clash in Chicago and Portland as the National Guard streams into the second city.
Number one. Today marks 2 years since the brutal Hamas terror attack on Israel that killed around 1,200 people. As Israelis remember that awful day, there is still some hope that a deal to end the war and release the remaining hostages is actually in sight.
2 years since the October 7th attacks, and we are finally at the cusp, perhaps, of getting hostages back, all of them, and possibly ending the fighting in Gaza. Yet demonstrations around the world are almost all anti-Israel, even though they were the victims of this Hamas massacre. It's simply twisted. And I'm, you know, Senator Cassidy, this is too much for me to ask of anybody, but can you make sense of that? That I'm going to see protests all through New York City as I go to the subway or the train for Hamas against Israel. I mean, 2 years later.
That is an incredible twisted interpretation of what happened over there, Brian. Thanks for having me on. But 2 years to the day in which people at a peaceful outdoor holiday concert were interrupted with gunshots, rape, murder, beheadings. And by the way, they specifically targeted kibbutzes that have been established to bridge differences between Palestinians and Israelis. That is being lost in the kind of overall worldwide sympathy for Hamas. Let's end the war, but also let's have a correct perspective.
Absolutely. So with this shutdown, as we move something a little bit more towards what you work on a daily basis, but Senator, has there been a move at all to talk to some Democrats that might want to come your direction? You just need five additional ones. It seems as though there's no effort to try to get Ossoff, who has to win in a red state, or Gary Peters, who's going to retire, or Jeanne Cheheen, who they say is the most logical person in the Senate. Has there been any effort there?
So I've not made such an effort because right now, frankly, Schumer's holding the strings. This is a Schumer shutdown. Schumer could release four of them. It could happen easily. So you're asking people to break from Schumer. That might be. You'd have to dangle something pretty tempting. Now, by the way, Republicans, you know, can't just sit by passively. We got to be thinking, how do we change this dynamic? But one way to help people understand, this is a Schumer shutdown. All we're asking for is 7 weeks of the current budget going forward so that we can continue to talk on the issues that are important.
So the whole focus now with Democrats, they say the reason they're doing this is to prevent the Medicaid cuts. But these Medicaid cuts came from the rescue plan because it increased eligibility as well as subsidies. Right now, Medicaid, people are getting Medicaid who are 400% over the poverty level, some making six-figure incomes. You're a doctor, so you want everyone. You know the problems with hospitals, have to treat everybody, and if you don't have insurance, where are they going to get the money? I understand that. But this is not what Medicaid was intended for. But politically, it's not easy to bring that up, correct? So how do you straddle it?
So there's two things, Brian. One, there is Medicaid, which was part of the Tax Cut for Working Families bill, and the other are the subsidies on the exchanges, which is about, I don't know, 6% of the American population. So they are complaining about both. So we've got to be careful. We've got to be considerate of high health care cost. But the subsidies have made high health care cost worse. Now, let that sink in. In fact, no, let's kind of channel a Washington Post article, editorial, which said recently that the Affordable Care Act failed. That, in a sense, the health care has become so expensive, it requires large subsidies for the policies the Affordable Care Act was supposed to make affordable. This is all upside down. What Republicans need to do, go back to square one. How do we actually make health care more affordable, no matter who's paying?
Yes.
And particularly for those small businesses that right now are getting caught in the updraft of high health care costs, let's lower health care costs for everybody. And that's going to take, I think, a more conservative approach than what the Democrats are proposing.
But you're not going to get that done in 3 weeks.
Well, it may not, but believe me, there's things you can do pretty simply. Not simply, but we know what to do to lower those costs. I'm hoping Democrats will join us, but right now they got to reopen the government.
So, Senator,
right now, shutting the government down does not help this go forward.
I mean, for the longest time, you guys are in the minority, and it was like, hey, we're going to shut this down. You're not going to get your 60 votes, and Republicans get the blame. Now it's Democrats in the minority. You're not going to get your 60 votes. And in a Washington Post poll, 38% blame Republicans, 30% blame Democrats. How does that sit with you?
Well, I'd like to know who they're polling, number one. But number two, Chuck Schumer is the one that points out that 13 times under Biden that there was an extension of a current budget to allow more negotiations, and every time Republicans supported all 13 of those. We have shown in the past that we will support continuing to negotiate. They are showing that, no, they want what they want, and they want it right now, and they're going to stamp their little foot up and down in order to get it. So let's open the government, continue our negotiations. We can do what is right.
All right. I know you have a few more minutes. There's something – you guys are still working, and you're working on something to make sure the labor laws are modernized. The Help Committee has got a hearing today on fixing a century-old labor laws to strengthen American rights in the workplace, and you're teaming with Teamsters President Sean O'Brien to bring this forward. Where are we archaic in when it comes to labor laws?
Think about the gig economy. Think about the Uber, the Lyft driver, the person who's working as a contractor, as an engineer for a firm that just needs 2 months of work. That was not anticipated 100 years ago. We need to have something now which is updated to today's modern economy, good for the worker, good for business, good for U.S. international competitiveness. Laws that are 100 years old don't bring us there. We need to hear from everybody to figure out how to go forward.
So, well, for example, what's going to be in there? Are you guys actually having a hearing to work it out, or do you have an idea of giving maybe gig workers who are banned in some cities where they feel unions feel as though they're detrimental, who are forced to get insurance or whatever the situation is? What would you see as a way to address some of these new challenges or in the new changes in modern law?
So this is the latest of a series of hearings. One bill that we have proposed is that if you are a gig worker and you're working for Lyft and Uber and DoorDash, that those three companies would be able to contribute to your 401k and to your health insurance policy without becoming your employer. You stay at your independent contractor status. You set your own hours. You can show up and leave whenever you want to, but they can still contribute to your retirement and to your health care. That's kind of modernizing how we approach labor laws. That's good for the worker. It's good for the business.
Understood. I just want to also bring you to Health and Human Services. Do you regret your vote for RFK Jr. as chairman?
You know, I live
Secretary.
Life forward. So RFK is doing some good things on things like ultra-processed food. I disagree with him strongly on restricting access to things like the COVID vaccine, making it more difficult for people to get – not talking about mandates, but making it more difficult for someone who wants a COVID shot to get the COVID shot, which I think is kind of odd. Operation Warp Speed was President Trump's crowning achievement. He opened up an economy which was shut down. He did it faster than anyone thought was possible. And we want the president to continue to have that kind of success. For whatever reason, the secretary decides that he doesn't like the vaccine. He's going to make it more difficult for patients to exercise their choice.
Right. And one thing about it, though, Senator, you have such sway, and I know he really respects you. Would you just get in there and work with him rather than wait for the hearings? Are you picking up the phone and working with him?
Absolutely. We communicate regularly and have a meeting already scheduled.
Great. Lastly, Sean Duffy on Transportation Secretary today. I know you got to run, but he says already we saw Burbank without any air traffic controllers. We saw a few show up over in Newark. We saw delays in Los Angeles and Denver and New Jersey. What are you hearing about what could be with this lockout? Are these air traffic controllers just not going to show up?
Well, right now they've not missed a paycheck because they're paid every 2 weeks. So they got paid at the end of last month. I'm hoping they continue to show up. I'm hoping that Schumer ends the shutdown because that way that air traffic will not be interrupted. By the way, we absolutely need them. There's a shortage already. I don't think we should be making their life more difficult.
Senator Bill Cassidy, I hear you. I hear the frustration, and I'll hope to talk to you again soon.
Thanks, Brian.
You got it. Meanwhile, bottom of the hour, Jackie Heinrich, and she'll bring us the latest from the White House. And she's also the host, co-host, the rotating anchor on Sunday Briefing. Back in a moment, 1-866-408-7669. Don't move.
Both sides, all opinions. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. It's Brian Kilmeade here. Are you tired of those uncomfortable dress shirts, especially when they bunch up under a sweater? If so, then you must check out Collars & Co., makers of the Dress Collar Polo. Listen up. These shirts are four-way stretch, buttery soft polos with firm dress collars on them, so they give you the dress shirt look, but extremely comfortable polo feel. You can wear them with anything, under a sweater, with a blazer, or by themselves as an elevated polo. They work for any occasion. These polos are perfect, whether it's in the office, on a golf course, or a night out. Collars & Co. is exploding and have gone viral on social media thanks to the $1 million investment they received on Shark Tank from Mark Cuban and Peter Jones. You don't have to worry about collars that flop down and spread out. They stay firm and sharp all day. It's an amazing array of sweaters, quarter zips, pants, and outerwear. If you're looking for the performance dress shirt or polo that looks great all day, check out collarsandco.com. Use promo code Brian for 15% off of any purchase of $100 or more. That's promo code Brian.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. It's Brian Kilmeade.
So far, the effects of the shutdown keep getting worse.
Millions of Americans this morning feeling the pain, experiencing delays at airports. Food benefits to moms and young children could dry up in days. And national parks and monuments are partially closed.
I don't want to hardship shame anyone, but there is a significant gap between partially closed monuments and your children will starve. People will be forced to eat their pets. And the Department of Treasury thermostats will have to be kept at 66. Wear a sweater. I mean, really, who's taking a hit on the monument thing?
This tourist, David, all the way from Italy, saying Alcatraz was supposed to be the highlight of his visit to the Bay.
I feel not good. Bad because I come from Italy for, say, Alcatraz, all the attraction, and now we can't. Then it's not good, feeling not good.
Hysterical. He was really good. He just, and you could tell the Democrats want to get rid of Chuck Schumer because he eviscerated Chuck Schumer last night. So that was also, you know, Mondays are good. I think that's an example, Allison. You thought SNL was funny at top. I think you lowered your bar so much.
Because, you were laughing at it yesterday.
Well, I was laughing at one line, the Tylenol line.
And the Jane Goodall.
Okay. but, I mean, compare that to Jon Stewart. I mean, you have an agenda through it, but there's funny. He just gets funny.
I don't love everything, but you just tell. I just think there's a huge difference. And like, you look at John Oliver, just angry. I mean, I don't know who he called out last week. Just, okay, you have a show for once a week, and he just eviscerated a different Republican every week. We'll see what happens.
Do you want to hear him go after Schumer?
Oh, you have it? Let's go.
We have that.
New data came out today from KFF, and that is not Kentucky Fried French Fries. KFF could be Kentucky French Fries.
Hmm? Yeah. Kaiser Family.
I know. Aren't.
Who is that joke even for? 6-year-olds that watch C-SPAN? What the f*** are you doing? Chuck Schumer is a human flat tire.
It's so right. But, you know, it's weird. In comedy, the reason why they go after Chuck Schumer is they want him out. Like, he would never go after AOC. He would never go after Mamdani. He'd go after Cuomo.
He would go after Cuomo. That means Schumer's giving him a lot to work with. Like, right. That was,
I mean, that was the stupidest joke ever.
Yes.
Right.
There was one beforehand. He was, like, shaking his hands. It was just too visual for radio, and he ripped him on that. But, it wouldn't have worked here. But this was just the second half of it. But, Schumer just really does give him a lot to go with.
I hear you. And that's what they were talking about. But, like, here's an example of why everything is upside down. I mean, you can't count on comedy anymore. That's one thing. The other thing is you can't count on logic. Obviously, October 7th, this horrific story where a bunch of innocent people were massacred who happened to be, ironically, so pro-Palestinian and were helping in Gaza Strip. They end up being targeted and over 1,000 people killed in the most brutal way possible, 200 plus taken hostage. And you would think around the world, there will be a moment of silence, a series of recognition, people holding up pictures of the hostages or those who lost their lives during the unprovoked attack. Instead, I'm getting all these messages in New York. Hey, there's going to be a protest here. There's going to be a protest there. Try to avoid the subways today. Try to avoid the trains. Protest, not against Hamas, a terror group, but against a bunch of people protesting against Israel, the only democracy and our ally in the region, because they say they didn't, I guess, want, and this is a day after, before even the attacks in Gaza started, they didn't want any retaliation, or they feel as though they understood proportional retaliation. Really? 2 years since the October 7th attack. Think about how much progress they have made for humanity with the pager attack, followed up by the walkie-talkie attack. Hezbollah. When you talk about taking out the nuclear program or retarding it for a few years, Iran. When you talk about neutralizing the Houthi rebels to the point where you can open up the strait again, you have great progress when it comes to Houthi rebels. And when it comes to Hamas, Israelis have killed almost all their leadership, but they've paid a big price. 1,142 IDF deaths. Now, other people have died. I don't believe anybody's numbers. I don't believe anybody denying anybody aid. Hamas is denying people aid. And, you know, we're going to talk to a former hostage at some point in our show. And at what point in his story, they talk about being above ground for the first 50 days and then going underground. Do you know where the door was to their underground tunnels? In a mosque. Do you know where the other doors are? In hospitals and in schools. And now you want to fault the IDF for targeting hospitals, schools, and mosques. I don't know. Do you think you're being played? Does anyone have a brain? And you're targeting the UN aid organizations who are working for, and some say they took part in, the October 7th attack. It is crazy. I am still hopeful to the 20-point plan that Trump outlined, led by Jared Kushner and Steve Witkoff, will be executed. And as we move to Egypt, I'm looking for any morsel of information. This is what I hear from Al Jazeera. They say so far, all people are positive, moving forward, logistics to get all the hostages out at one time. Here's Dave Ignatius of the Washington Post, cut 6.
This peace plan came together really because Kushner, with Trump's backing, took all the elements that Arab countries, Israel, all the players had been working on, sometimes for more than a year, and pushed them together and demanded that they be acted on. You know, suddenly this became a 20-point peace plan, Donald Trump's peace plan, but it was something that was pulled together, really, as you say, over a weekend.
And it was effective, and it doesn't say Palestinian state, two-state solution, and this is what it's going to look like. What they said is gradually pull back to a yellow line inside Gaza, let the fighting cease. here's the number of prisoners that are going to be let out. Sadly, it's way too high. And we get all the hostages out, including the bodies of the hostages that are still there. And then we talk about a peace body, and then it's going to transition to a transitional body, and then hopefully to a Palestinian technocrats who don't want to kill people for a living.
It's Will Cain Country. Watch it live at noon Eastern, Monday through Thursday at FoxNews.com or on the Fox News YouTube channel. And don't miss the show. Listen and follow the podcast 5 days a week at FoxNewsPodcasts.com or wherever you download your favorite podcasts.
If you're interested in it, Brian's talking about it. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
After five failed votes, it should be clear to Republicans that we cannot go forward unless they sit down and seriously negotiate with Democrats to address the health care crisis. It's that simple. The bottom line is that the American people know if they do layoffs, if they do RIFs, it falls on Donald Trump's shoulders. He's doing it, not Democrats, and the American people know that.
Senator Chuck Schumer not budging. He has still has three defectors. They get five more. They can go back to work. Then they're going to continue to do this. They'll do some votes today. That's what Chuck Schumer's saying. Make my health care changes or we don't go back to work. And President Trump, as far as I could tell, not engaged. And I think that's the preference of leadership, to leave him out of this and focus on other things. I think that that might be the plan. And I think he's okay with that. Jackie Heinrich, senior White House correspondent, rotating anchor on Sunday Briefing. She's up this week. Hey, Jackie, what are your thoughts? What are your thoughts about Chuck Schumer's opinion? It says if they start cutting jobs, it's on Trump.
Well, you listen to that, and the spin is just incredible because you have Senate Democrats who have voted now five times against a bill in the Republican side to reopen the government, the same bill that passed the House, including with a couple of their colleagues, by the way, who voted in support of it. And so I think Schumer is outwardly maintaining this sort of appearance of defiance, but I'm not sure how long it lasts, because you can play the tape. God knows how many times you've heard Democrats arguing against closing down the government because of any sort of political dispute. And the only thing he has in that clip that I think might have the White House's attention is the layoff question, because we were told initially, the Democrats are closing down the government, and therefore we're going to have to do all these mass layoffs. You haven't seen the layoffs come to pass yet, and you did see messaging that was a little bit uneven from the White House. On the one hand, they were saying, unfortunately, we're going to have to talk about these layoffs because the Democrats won't open the government. On the other hand, you had the president sort of echoing Russ's vote, saying, what an opportunity to cut the waste, fraud, and abuse. Can't believe that they handed me this golden chance to cut more federal workers. So I think that they took a step back from that, and they are letting, rightly, Democrats sort of stewing their own juice over whether or not they can actually get on board with a bill to reopen the government, because all they have in the meantime is just to repeat what is flatly wrong, that there is, the Republicans are not opening the government. That's just not true.
So, Jackie, this the one thing that I think will affect American people and maybe put a more rush to get some type of answer or to restart the government is if you start saying that planes aren't landing on time or not landing at all and the flights are canceled, and already we're seeing a slowdown with air traffic controllers. Listen to Secretary of Transportation Sean Duffy, 43.
In a job that's already stressful, this shutdown has put way more stress on our controllers at a time when they're already working on equipment from the 1960s, 1980s, 1990s, we ask them to do their jobs on equipment that has not been state-of-the-art. We ask them to do their jobs on old equipment and keep our airports operational at a time when they don't have the best equipment at their disposal. And so I wanted to hear them out. I wanted to hear their concerns and make sure that that those who shut the government down, I want to make sure that Chuck Schumer and Hakeem Jeffries know that this is not consequence free.
And so far, we see that there was no air traffic controllers in Burbank. There seems to be a shortage again in New Jersey, and there were delays in Denver and Los Angeles. So don't you believe that that's the whole different type of challenge that will get both sides' attention?
I think people are going to start getting impatient when they start missing paychecks, when their, you know, travel gets jeopardized, like you just mentioned in the clip you just played from Sean Duffy, when the SNAP funding runs out and women can't buy their baby formula. I think that the sort of pressures are going to start compounding the longer this goes on. The one space where you might see a negotiation, the president signaled openness to this yesterday. He said, we could do a deal on the Obamacare subsidies. Now, the Democrats want to extend the expanded, you know, COVID-era subsidies. Republicans are going to also be facing some pressure to do some sort of an extension, because if they don't, it is true that you're going to have letters going out at the end of this month, next month, you know, through the end of the year, because all these health companies are setting their rates for next year. And they're going to have people in their districts that are getting letters saying that their premiums are, you know, increasing. And so that is one space where they might be able to have a negotiation. There's still, you know, a sort of gap between the Senate and the House on this issue. Mike Johnson saying in the House, look, we've done our job. We passed the bill. We don't need to talk about this. The subsidies don't expire actually till the end of the year. Let's have this discussion when the government is open. In the Senate, you may need to have a bit of a discussion ahead of time. At least that's what Thune has been hearing from his constituent or his members in that chamber. And the president said yesterday, we could probably do a deal on that. It would have to be the right deal. So maybe not a, you know, wholesale approval of the COVID era levels, but some sort of a negotiation, because the Democrats are correct when they say that, you know, people will have their premiums go up if we don't resolve this. And the Republicans know that, too. The question is just, when do we do this? Is it with the government closed while the Democrats hold this whole process hostage, or is it reasonable once the government reopens and we can actually do some real policy work?
So do you believe that Republican leadership wants to keep it to between Republicans and Democrat leadership in the House and Senate, and they don't really want the president involved in this to keep him out of it for now?
I think that they're giving a little more time to letting Democrats sort of twist in the wind. There is no advantage right now to engaging for them yet, because Democrats have not of their demands. As of, you know, yesterday, they're still voting on the bill in the Senate, the Democrats' alternative, that would repeal the entire Big Beautiful Bill health care title. That, you know, is the same legislation that Republicans have been saying all along prioritizes health care for illegal immigrants. There are nuances to that. You know, there are different avenues through which the money can go to benefit both undocumented or lawful non-citizens and illegal immigrants. But point being, you know, the Democrats have not come up with a better proposal yet. And so they really need to, you know, change their demand, because you're not seeing any Republicans move off of their support to reopen the government. It's just a waiting game at this point. You know, who blinks first?
Right. And right now, people can get Medicaid who are above 400% of the poverty level. That was done during the American Rescue Plan during the pandemic. There are people in households making six figures that are getting Medicaid. That's not what it was intended for. But they raised the bar on eligibility during the pandemic. According to reports, the pandemic's over, and that's what the Republicans are trying to get across.
That's right. And I think that there will be some sort of a negotiation on the Obamacare subsidies, but I'm not sure it'll end up being that COVID-level expanded subsidy.
Understood. We'll see what happens. We'll see who can message this better, and we'll see if we get an end to this week. And then if they just finish their appropriations bills on time, in theory, we wouldn't have this problem ever. But, Jackie, I want to bring you to the other big story, and that's what's happening over in Egypt. They're trying to bring back all the hostages and finally end the fighting with Hamas. And the 20-point plan is having trouble finding critics. And I noticed that. No matter what they were talking about with Trump, and they say they're normal stuff with the administration, I understood it. When it came to talking bad stuff about this plan and the possibilities to get the hostages out, very few critics. And this struck me. This is what Andrea Mitchell said, one of the president's biggest critics.
The important thing is that Hamas is now really isolated. Ooh. The Arab countries all came together in New York when they were here for the UN meetings with the president. That is a huge factor. And partly that's because of Israel's biggest mistake, which was to attack Qatar. This united the Arab world. It infuriated President Trump. For the first time, we're seeing President Trump really putting pressure on Netanyahu to stop the bombing. When he said that, it was very significant. So this could be transformational. And you know, if this were to work out and it, you know, it would be the Abraham Accords, it would be recognition of Israel, transform the whole region, and President Trump would deserve that Nobel Prize.
She hated saying it, but do you hear that? I mean, are people kind of surprised that he put up to with a plan that's got so much Arab buy-in, Israeli buy-in, and maybe Hamas?
Well, I think she's correct in saying that the support of the Arab world for a deal now and to not waste time and let this, you know, keep sort of evolving, this two-year-long war. I think she's right in saying that the strikes in Qatar and, you know, brought us to this point. You heard the president after those strikes, even though they were very upset. It destabilized the region, threatened the Abraham Accords. You know, the messaging out of the White House at that point was, you know, we think this is an opportunity, actually. And no one could really understand what they meant by that. Now we're starting to see what they meant, because you do have sort of a united voice from the U.S. and from these Arab countries to Netanyahu to be like, look, it's time. You got to make a decision. We've got to negotiate something. And Hamas also recognizing that, you know, the long arm of Israel is not going to stop reaching for them if they don't. Now, I don't know if it is a good enough deal for Israel, especially as we've been hearing very little from Hamas about what they're trying to get changed. We heard right after the 20-point plan was announced that there were intense negotiations happening, which would suggest that maybe some of those 20 points were up for review. Don't know what they are. Don't know if that's acceptable to Israel. There were some big differences between what Bibi said he would accept and what was in that plan, at least as it was initially reported, including a role for the Palestinian Authority in the future governance of Gaza. But the president, you know, took a hard line with Israel. We understand from his meetings with Netanyahu, what was it, last Monday, and then, you know, the discussions after the Qatar strikes, and he wants to get this deal done. Yeah. And so we'll see how it works out, but it depends on if Israel is asked to give up too much also.
So there's on this podcast hosted by Jason Tardik, called Trading Secrets. He had Caitlin Collins on, and they talked about something you probably could relate to: the challenges of traveling with the president, this president, Donald Trump.
I did Fox and Friends finance segment, and it was just on Gen Z's and finance. And one of the executive producers, like, we just want to show you around. And they showed me the control room. And I said, how have things been in the control room as of late? And she's like, none of us are sleeping because the president doesn't sleep. We're all working two times right now. Do you feel that?
You know,
way?
I was just talking to someone about this because we wrote this story on what traveling with him is like.
Yeah.
In the first term, because I had this source who said, you never want to be on Air Force One on a trip. And I said, why? Like, you'd think you want to be in the axis of power close to Trump. He doesn't sleep on these trips. And like, you know, you're going to Asia or something, and that's kind of the only time you're going to sleep before you go on this trip.
Yeah.
But Trump is just always up and talking, and he'll like have them go wake staff up if they're asleep because he wants to talk to them.
Huh.
And so we have this big trip to Asia coming up, and you know, you're not going to sleep on that flight.
Your thoughts? Can you add to that?
I agree on one point. You don't want to be on Air Force One on a trip to Asia, but it's not because he doesn't sleep. It's because the chairs don't recline.
Oh,
it's an uncomfortable flight. But you know, she's right that the president is up at all hours. You know this, Brian, working on your show so early in the morning and late at night in One Nation, you know, round the clock, there's something to cover. I think it's exciting. I think that it's, you know, one of the highlights of my career is covering this president. It's every day is something new. Today we're the pool. We'll be in the Oval Office. It's a privilege and an opportunity to, you know, witness history from the front row. But these trips are busy, and we do have a big one coming up at the end of the month. Looks like it might be three countries and a lot of news coming out of that. So we're excited.
Yeah. So take the challenge and give up the sleep and try to get chairs that recline.
Yeah.
Jackie, thanks so much. Do you know who's going to be on the briefing yet, or so too early? It's only Tuesday.
It's a little early right now. We've got some irons in the fire, but we'll let you know when we got confirmation.
Sundays at 11 o'clock. Jackie Heinrich, 6 days a week. Thanks, Jackie. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Brian.
All right, we're going to come back and finish up with some phone calls, or if you'd rather write, briankilmeade.com. We also did not talk about this yet, and that is Texas National Guard heading to Chicago while a judge stopped National Guard from going to Portland. It didn't stop the singing, though. Brian Kilmeade Show.
Learning something new every day on The Brian Kilmeade Show. Radio that makes you think. This is The Brian Kilmeade Show.
A couple of years ago, I said very candidly that the right wing in this country wants a rematch of the Civil War. I want that to sit in right now because the President of the United States of America has declared war on the people of Chicago and people across America.
Just such an irresponsible statement and could not be more inaccurate. And plus, do you realize the right wing of the country, there was the Republicans led by Abraham Lincoln who tried to bring the country back together and war was the only option? So you might want to get your history straight. Number two, since when does rounding up criminals and illegal immigrants mean you want a civil war? People that don't belong here, that have committed crimes, are being rounded up with no help from the local police. That, to me, is the insubordination. It should be unconstitutional to have a sanctuary city that goes against federal policy. You know, but I don't have that legal degree, and I don't think Mayor Brandon Johnson does, nor do I think anybody is holding this guy responsible for those type of statements. Pritzker's the same way. Listen to this. Cut 12.
I refuse to let Donald Trump, Kristi Noem, and Gregory Bovino continue on this march toward autocracy. Their plan all along has been to cause chaos. The state of Illinois is going to use every lever at our disposal to resist this power grab and get Noem's thugs the hell out of Chicago. I'm not afraid. Okay. I am not afraid.
Okay, just we can stop it there. Number one, you'd be afraid. What are you afraid of? Why is that a big deal? You're not afraid. You're sitting there with federal guards living in a beautiful section. Your family's multi-billionaires. You never had to work a day in your life. What do you have to be afraid of? No one's targeting you. And by the way, for the record, he is calling ICE thugs. He's calling ATF thugs. He's calling Border Patrol thugs. Is that okay with you? Just think about that. Don't tell me about Donald Trump's popularity when it comes to illegal immigrants in our midst. Just remember in your mind the overflow from the Roosevelt Hotel in New York City. And know there was 35 other hotels like that. And keep in the back of your mind what O'Hare Airport looked like, as it looked like a big slumber party with illegal immigrants scattered all over. Guess who's paying for their food and for their shelter? You were paying for all that. No one cared about that. Nobody said how irresponsible it was. Yeah, we were saying it. But nobody else did. Now, it's up to this president to come up, clean up that mess. Many of those people were flat-out criminals. Now we know an organized effort from Venezuela to send TDA here and market drugs full circle. You have a president rounding these people up with no help from these blue cities. Now, in Memphis, you have, and in D.C., you have Democratic mayors, but you have a governor in Tennessee who needs help in Memphis, and he's getting it and liking it. The mayor's not stood in his way to his credit, and she is not standing in the way in Washington, D.C., and they're getting results, and it's coming from federal dollars. Yet you have somebody saying the president wants to reignite a civil war. They're looking for illegal immigrants. That includes all nationalities. But they are looking for TDA in particular. And yesterday they picked up a member of the Latin Kings, a gang who's allowed to thrive in Chicago, who put bounties on the head of ICE officials. They'll pay you $10,000 to kill one. We put a stop to that. Those thugs, in his terms, put a stop to that. Brian Kilmeade Show. Make sure you keep it here.
News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan. It's the fastest growing radio talk show. Brian Kilmeade.
From 40th and 6th in Midtown Manhattan, heard around the country, around the world, this is the Brian Kilmeade Show. With this hour, we'll be joined by Senator Steve Daines. We'll do a simulcast with Stuart Varney on FBN. We're looking at a series of things. You know, it's not like the Senate isn't working. Pam Bondi is on Capitol Hill. Of course, every Democrat wants to bring up the Epstein situation and what's going on in these cities. And she's more than happy to talk about fighting crime in these cities and the lack of cooperation with the sanctuary cities. So it's explosive. We'll keep you up to date on that. But with me now in studio is Douglas Murray. And Douglas, always great to see you, but especially today, 2 years since the October 7th attack. And you know what I'm getting memos about? Be aware of the protest as you leave the building. for the Palestinians, for Hamas, condemning the Israelis. Now, in your book, you write about that a day or two after, or that day of October 7th, when the massacre is taking place or just completed, already Hamas was getting supporters in Times Square in New York. Yeah. So this shouldn't surprise you, but I am horrified by it.
Yeah, I described that in my recent book on democracies and death cults, that on the 8th of October, I went down to Times Square here in the center of New York, and there were hundreds and hundreds of people celebrating the massacres, supporting Hamas. The massacres were still going on the 8th of October.
Yeah.
There were still Hamas terrorists inside Israel slaughtering people. And we saw at the beginning of this war a disgusting problem that is a problem not for Israel, but for us in America, us in the wider West, us in Britain, Canada, Australia, and so on, which is why after this atrocity, this war that Hamas started, did so many people in our societies decide to put themselves on the side not of the Israelis, not even actually of the Palestinian people and the quest for statehood and all that sort of thing, but on the side of the death cult of Hamas, on the side of Hezbollah that joined in the war on the 8th of October 2023. This is a lingering problem in our society, and it is growing.
So we had Mark Levin on an hour ago on Fox and Friends, and one of the things he said is we're 5 years ahead of London and France in terms of extremists coming into your country, allowing your borders to be open and begin to change the character of your country. He sees what's happening in Dearborn. He sees these protests in major cities, especially in New York City, and said, this is a five-alarm fire. Do you see it that way?
Absolutely. Just consider the fact that one of the most frequent chants on American campuses and American streets in this city since the 7th of October 2023 has been globalize the Intifada. There are people in Western city after Western city today, including, by the way, this morning I just saw in London, calling for globalize the Intifada. You see, we know what that means. The people of Israel know what that means. Intifada is the use of terrorism against innocent people. And this city that we're sitting in got a very big dose of Intifada 24 years ago on 9/11/2001. Last week, in Manchester, in the north of England, a man called Jihad, rammed a car into Jews outside a synagogue, going into service, and started stabbing at them, shouting Allahu Akbar, globalizing the Intifada. That's what it means. We should be under no illusions about this. And we here in New York have a lead candidate for mayor of this city, 24 years after 9/11, who has said that he wouldn't currently use the phrase globalize the Intifada, but of course he understands it. And his friends all use the phrase. What have we come to?
I agree with you. I'm embarrassed to work here. I love the building. Don't love the city. Long Island, dramatically different. Upstate New York, dramatically different. I mean, I don't know if you're familiar with the area, Douglas, but if you go to Nassau County or Suffolk County, that's why the governor hates him. It hates Long Island. And you go to upstate New York, where three of my kids went to college, the further up you go, the more you get people who are more open to different school of thought, not radicalized New York City dwellers. But I thought about this, I want to play a soundbite now because you really beat him to the punch by about a year. But it outlines the idiocy of calling what's happening in Gaza genocide. Here's Scott Galloway trying to teach MSNBC what's really going on here.
2,200 American servicemen killed at Pearl Harbor. We go on to kill 3.5 million Japanese, including 100,000 in one night. 2,800 Americans in 9/11. We go on to kill 400,000 people in Afghanistan and Iraq. We weren't accused of genocide. You had, if Mexico had elected a jihadist cartel to run their country and then they incurred into Texas and on a per capita basis killed 35,000 people or the population of the University of Texas and on the way back took the freshman class at SMU hostage and hid them under tunnels, what would we do? It'd be the great Sonora radioactive parking lot. But Jews are not allowed, and Israel is not allowed to prosecute a war. And they are prosecuting a war more humanely than we have done. The ratio of combatants to civilians is of civilian death to combatant mortality is lower than it was in Mosul, lower than it was in Japan, lower than it was in Germany. So there's just a different standard for Jews in Israel when it comes to prosecuting a war. They're allowed to fight back to a truce. But unlike America or any other Western nation that has attacked this viciously, they're not allowed to win a war. It's a double standard.
Make you feel better that somebody else gets it?
Yes, very much so. I've been saying this from the beginning because since before October the 7th, the Zora Mamdanis and others were saying that Israel was committing genocide in Gaza. They said that before this war that Hamas started.
Yeah.
And they've been saying
it. They called it an outdoor prison.
Yeah, they've been saying it every single day since October the 7th, 2023. They've been saying genocide. Genocide is a very specific thing. It is the deliberate attempt and effort to eradicate an entire race of people. I have been with the IDF in Gaza, in Lebanon, and elsewhere in the last few years. The idea that these soldiers are trying to wipe out the Palestinians of Gaza or the people of Lebanon or anywhere else is preposterous. It is, if they wanted to do it, they could have done. I mean, they don't want to, but if they wanted to, they could have done because they've had 2 years. Instead, they have been doing house-to-house operations in Gaza, taking out tunnel entrances, trying to rescue the hostages, trying to destroy the leadership of Hamas. That's what they've been doing. But just consider, even this morning, I don't want to harp on about him too much, but even this morning, the likely next mayor of New York City made a cursory reference in a tweet to the fact that there had been a massacre 2 years ago in Israel, and then talked about the genocide in Gaza. These people who have been pushing this lie that has become so mainstream in recent years, which we have heard on the airwaves, we've heard politicians say it, we've heard people who want to be elected politicians say it, we've heard it across all of the campuses of this country. These people are saying something that is a lie, and it is causing a whipping up of hatred. And we know, again, we know what globalized intifada means. Only a few months ago in Washington, D.C., two young people, they happened to be working for the Israeli embassy in D.C., but they were killed by somebody when they were walking out of an event at the Jewish Museum in Washington. And they were shot dead on the streets of D.C., this young couple, by somebody screaming, "Free Palestine." All the people who have been pushing the intifada talk, pushing the genocide lie, pushing the free Palestine, support Hamas lie, these people are whipping up people into violence and the blood will be on their hands.
100% correct. But Douglas, do you realize when it comes to Mamdani, this is the time when you modulate your views to get the most people possible to vote for you? Do you realize how much worse it's going to be if he gets the job?
Oh, I've seen Mamdani like figures in the UK and elsewhere for years. I know exactly how they do this. They have very radical views, very sectarian, nasty, ugly views. But they hide them for the months before they need to get into office. And they go on things like The View. And when they're asked, you know, 5 years ago, you said that the police in America are racist and misogynistic and homophobic and transphobic and that they should be defunded. Do you still agree with that? And he says, look, my views have evolved. Yeah, he's 33 years old. So many people say something at 28 that they totally disagree with at 33. Yeah, sure, he wasn't a kid. But he goes on shows like that, and then he smiles, and he's nice, and it all slips by, and he can get into office and then do what he really wants.
See, this is what blows me away, because I'll take it even further. They say, have you apologized for your past comments about the NYPD being racist? He says, when I see cops individually, I have conversations with them. I mean, do you realize if he's not able to say, I apologize, man, I don't know what I was thinking. I was caught up in the George Floyd. You know I don't feel that, and I like to say to any— That's what you do, even if you don't believe it. But you know what scares me is that he knows he can't do that because a lot of the 400,000 people that gave him the primary victory feel the same way.
Yes.
So he's got to not alienate them.
Yeah.
At the same time, tell people that you don't have to fear me. Well, I do fear what he could do.
Absolutely. He cannot condemn people calling for intifada in New York, and he cannot say that he doesn't think that our police in New York, the NYPD, are racist and misogynistic and homophobic and transphobic. He can't say it because this is what his base believe. They want intifada. They want the right to call for intifada. They want to say that our police in New York are racist. They want to defund the police. So he's got to keep them on side whilst trying to fool some decent people, some gullible idiots into voting for him. But you're so right, Brian. Outside of the kind of maniac centers that we have in this country, like all Western countries, I do believe that most people out there are decent people.
Right.
They realize that the people who is calling for intifada, the people who say our police are racist in America and so on, they always hate Israel first, but they always hate America next. Always. You cannot be somebody who is patriotic for Britain or America or Canada and be calling for intifada or support for Hamas or support for Hezbollah or support for the Iranian Revolutionary Government in Iran. You can't be. Because all of these people hate the Jewish state first and hate us in America and the rest of the West next.
Douglas Murray, we're going to continue this conversation. I'll leave some quality time on the other side because I do think there's a reason for hope. And I do want to get your sense of what's going to come out of Cairo, Egypt, as they negotiate an end to this conflict for now. And the bottom of the hour, Senator Steve Daines. Brian Kilmeade Show with Douglas Murray. Don't move.
It's Brian Kilmeade. Breaking news, unique opinions. Hear it all on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
And in the negotiations, do you have any red lines in terms of Hamas disarming and whatnot?
I have red lines. If certain things aren't met, we're not going to do it. But I think we're doing very well, and I think Hamas has been agreeing to things that are very important.
So how are the negotiations going? I saw Al Jazeera English, read Arab news the best I can. I don't read Arabic. And didn't see much in the American newspapers that things are progressing and they're working on logistics about getting the hostages out. Douglas Murray, journalist, associate editor of The Spectator, New York Post columnist, senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute, author of On Democracies and Death Cult Israel and the Future of Civilization. Perfect guest for today. What worries you is that we had a deadline and it's been extended. There might be reasons for it, but it's always tough when you have a deadline and have to bend it, correct?
President Trump said very clearly last week that Hamas had until Sunday to release the hostages and put down its weapons and agree to the deal. And the Trump deal is a very, very good deal. The 20-point plan is a very comprehensive plan. It's got the agreement of the Israelis and of all the Arab countries in the region. And Sunday has passed. We're now in Tuesday. It was on Friday last week that Hamas said they were willing to start negotiating. But this is what Hamas do. They always do this. They always drag out and draw out these sort of negotiations. Today, the word is that I've had is that Hamas is now saying that in exchange for releasing the Israeli hostages that they still have hold of, who they've had hold of now for 2 years, they're thought to be about 20 people who are alive. And just a reminder of how sick the death cult of Hamas is, about 30 dead Jewish bodies that they're holding on to as collateral for negotiating chips. They've said, Hamas now, that in exchange for these living and dead Israeli hostages, they would like not just some of the prisoners who they have insisted, which is hundreds of prisoners.
1,700 Gazans jailed and 250 Palestinian prisoners, many of which on life sentences.
Yes.
250 on life sentences, which means they killed before.
Yes. These are convicted terrorists in Israeli jails. But the word today is that Hamas also wants Israel to release the terrorists they are holding who were captured on the 7th of October who were taking part in the massacre. Now that is an absolute
non-starter,
impossible thing for the Israelis to agree to. And they should not be pushed into that. I'm one of the few journalists who's been in to see the terrorists of October the 7th in the jails that they're held in Israel. These are killers. These are killers. They're rapists. They are mass murderers. They're psychopaths. They should never see the light of day again. And the idea that 2 days after the president's deadline has passed, Hamas would raise this, that they want these people back, these murderers and rapists, they want them back in exchange for innocent Israelis and the dead bodies of innocent Israelis, this is definitely an impossibility. So if Hamas push for that, there can't be a deal.
I agree. That's a non-starter. How much does Egypt, Turkey, UAE, Qatar, Indonesia, whoever else is taking part in this, the pressure that they seem to sincerely have on Hamas, that would make a difference, correct? If they just said, no, guys, you're not, forget, that's not going to be a request of yours. It's not going to be honored. Could they be at the, we're not there, but could they be in there, or are they just going to sit back and see how it goes?
The crucial one in that is Qatar. Qatar is the most tricky, to say the least, country in this equation. They are the people, apart from the Iranian Revolutionary Government in Iran, who have been backing Hamas. They are the country that has been hosting Hamas, whereas the Iranian Revolutionary Government in Iran has been weakened, not least by American and Israeli strikes in June of this year. Qatar has pretty much got away with it. They have got away with their terrorism supporting. And in my mind, far too little pressure has been put on them in order that they, in turn, put pressure on Hamas. But if Qatar says, you have lost now, Hamas, every friend, you will have no backing, you will all be dead, you will get nothing of what you want, then that might be the thing that unlocks the deal.
Does Kushner and Witkoff do that? Or does Trump do that? Tell Qatar, go in there and do it. I love that they took a shot at those terrorists. I'm sad that they missed in Qatar, but that seems to have changed the dynamics.
It does slightly. I thought that the attack on the Hamas leadership in Qatar came almost 2 years too late. I would have liked to have seen that happen on the 8th of October, 2023. But Qatar is seen by many in the Trump administration, particularly the negotiator Steve Witkoff, as a friend, an ally. And that's flat out wrong. They are a very nefarious actor. The mother of the leader mourned Yahya Sinwar, who started this war, the head of Hamas. She mourned him when he was killed. I think that Qatar is the link to unlocking this. I very much hope that President Trump tells Steve Witkoff to lean on them like hell in order that Hamas are finally over.
10 seconds left. Will the hostages be coming out this week? Douglas, what do you think?
All I can do is pray, like everyone else, that they do and that they are not swapped for murderers.
The fastest 3 hours in radio. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
So, Mr. Leader, again, longest shutdown was during the first Trump presidency. This is what you said at the time about that particular shutdown. Here it is.
We are willing to take what Senate Republicans have done in order to reopen the government so that we no longer are holding 800,000 federal workers hostage.
Well, that's exactly what you're doing right now. Hundreds of thousands of workers are being held hostage. What's changed from then to now?
Well, actually, Donald Trump is the president. Republicans control the House, the Senate, and the presidency. They can reopen the government if they chose to. The reality
is... Well, they would have to change the rules to be fair.
Well, that's correct, but which they've done multiple times.
So what a great job. I don't know what his first name is, but with the anchor of the Today Show did. I'm busy at the time. Just pinning him to the mat and just saying, of course, this is the stupidest thing, this shutdown. You have points, you don't have points, whatever you think of his healthcare debate and wanting to leave the inflated rate of 400% over the poverty level to be eligible for Medicaid. Whatever you believe, you believe. You don't shut the government down because of that. That's not the debate. You do it in appropriations. And I thought today show holding his feet to the fire is certainly surprising and welcome. Senator Steve James joins us now. You know, he's on Finance, Foreign Relations and Energy Committee. He's still at work today, hoping to meet. Will be another test vote. But so far, only 3 Dems. You need 5 more to get the government back. Senator, how would you rate your level of frustration right now?
Well, Brian, it's very high, and it's only going to increase as you start to see troops not getting paid, benefits going to women and children who are in poverty. That's coming next, Brian, if the Democrats don't cooperate with us. And look, this is all about political theater. I haven't seen this kind of political theater since Hamilton. I mean, that's what's going on. This is truly, truly about Chuck Schumer seeing what happened last time that they agreed to a CR back in March when he got retribution from the radical far-left loonies and crazies of the Democrat Party. They're holding him hostage, and as a result, he's taken the government hostage in this shutdown. That's where it's at. That's the truth. We need five Democrat senators to agree with us for what they call a clean continuing resolution, which just means a funding bridge between now and November 21st to hash out the appropriations, to go through the regular order of putting together spending bills and move on. Something that the Democrats did 13 times when Joe Biden was president, but now that Trump is president, they can't do it. And Brian, there's another important point that I was talking with Tom Cotton last night about this. Tom's been out on TV today talking about it, and that is there is a No Kings, basically anti-Trump rally that's nationwide in scope, planned for October 18th. The far left has got a game plan here. This is very orchestrated. They want to build a crescendo for this massive national No Kings rally, which is Trump derangement syndrome, for October 18th. So I can see where there's going to hold until the 18th of October, allow the far left to have their rallies across this country. But that's going to take the temperature up in this country. And this is a time we need to take the temperature down, not up. So, if American people aren't seeing this as pure political theater, they're missing the main point.
I do. I understand it. So right now, just give me an idea of the tactics, because sometimes you guys talk and the talks break up. But this time, I don't see anybody talking. I know Senators Shaheen behind the scenes was mentioning doing something last week. Senator Collins had some ideas this week. What are you seeing happening outside of leadership?
Well, there is, and this is something that leadership has put on the table. I'm part of John Thune's leadership team. Here's the simple message. We are ready to continue to negotiate and work through some of the impasse, but we do that after we open the government up. And that's the deal. Until the government's opened back up, there's not going to be a negotiation. But there's a good faith commitment to negotiate after we get the government opened back up. You can't allow and reward bad behavior of taking the government hostage with a shutdown. Mm-hmm. Who wants to be the party that's not going to be paying the U.S. troops? It's not going to be us. So let's open things back up. Let's make sure TSA agents are getting paid. Let's make sure government employees who are doing their jobs faithfully every day are getting paid, and then we can start negotiations.
I hear you. So the shutdown is going on right now, and they say it's over Medicare and the cuts that are going to be coming their way. But I think the further, unless I'm wrong, it's all about the inflation of eligibility and money flowing into Medicare and Medicaid during the pandemic, during that rescue plan that Larry Summers, as well as Jason Furman, two economists from Democratic administration, said we didn't need. And right now, Medicaid, people who are making within 400% of the poverty level, above it, get Medicaid. And it's not what it was intended for. It's unaffordable. We have all these ways to cut spending. Nobody wants anyone to not have health insurance, but you have to do what's possible. If you have a six-figure income, you should not be on Medicaid.
So this is being lost in the debate around why the Democrats have taken this hostage. It is exactly what you described there, Brian. You go back to COVID era, these massive subsidies that were meant to be temporary, they've been extended twice already. The Democrats want to make these permanent. In other words, allowing people in excess of 400% of the poverty level, federal poverty level, to continue to get these benefits. These subsidies will exist if this temporary program ceases and desists, because there are already going to be subsidies in place up to 400% of the federal poverty level. Those are preserved. What the Democrats want to do is keep subsidies for those be above 400%. 400% federal poverty level. It's a $350 billion expenditure. It is absolutely riddled with waste and fraud abuse. Frankly, it's a massive scam for the insurance companies. They're taking advantage of this. But this is why the Democrats are shutting the government for that fight. It is truly ridiculous.
All right, if you want to turn up the heat, tell people their flights are canceled, tell them they can't land, tell them they're delayed, and I cannot believe 6 days in without missing a paycheck, air traffic controllers are choosing not to show. In Burbank, nobody showed up. In Newark, people are sitting out. In Denver, Los Angeles, there were massive delays. So we had the Secretary of Transportation on with us. He's in a tough spot. You don't want to call out air traffic controllers who are tense and undermanned and overworked already, but this should not be what they do, in my view. Here's what Sean Duffy said.
Cycle ended yesterday, right? Their paychecks come next week. And they see what's on the horizon, Brian. They're like, listen, do I see a resolution to the shutdown? I don't see it. So guess what? I'm concerned about my own life, my own family. And what we do is say, again, I want people when they travel to get to where they're going. So if we don't have controllers, we're going to make sure the airspace is safe. So what we do is we'll slow traffic, we'll shut down traffic, and that's what you saw in Burbank. We saw, you know, significant delays because controllers weren't there.
So this is the worry. If you start saying Newark shut down, LaGuardia shut down, LAX says nobody, what happens?
Well, this moves to the real serious stage real fast. I'll call those first few days are like the honeymoon period of a shutdown. Nobody's really feeling the effects of it. It gets real this week. If we don't act this week, then you start seeing this cascading effect of paychecks not going out. We'll have until early next week to act before the troops don't get paid. This becomes a serious problem. I remember this from the 2013 shutdown. And what happens here is the Democrats have taken a hostage. They're flying into a box canyon. There's no strategy to get out. They will not get any political win or policy win. They're just going to have their hissy fit. But the problem is the real, you know, rank and file Americans are going to suffer because of their ideological protest they're having. But you should not be allowed to shut the government down as a negotiating tool or leverage. That's why I firmly support legislation that we voted on, by the way, last week, that would eliminate government shutdowns. Do not allow members of Congress to use this. It's a dangerous tool. And furthermore, it costs the taxpayer a lot of money. Right now, they're estimating it's tens of billion dollars a day additional costs for the taxpayer because of the shutdown. So this is a bad deal for taxpayers and as well as disrupting services. When you start seeing these airports delaying flights, when you start seeing TSA agents not showing up for work, now you have the passengers, the flying public, not being able to get to their flights in time. And this is just the beginning of really a scenario that's going to get a lot worse. That's why the Democrats need to work with us, five of them. We need five Dems to vote with us today.
Right.
We open it back up, and then we will start good faith negotiations.
20 seconds. Will you work and try to find those Democrats?
We are. We're working on it as we speak. You know, we have the quiet conversations. But I'll tell you what, they're held by Chuck Schumer, and they're held by the radical left. That's the problem.
Problem is the radical left is not going to help John Ossoff win in Georgia.
He's not going to help him, though.
Senator Steve Daines, always great to talk to you. You know so much and get your hands dirty in so many issues. That's why it's always great for our audience to hear what the latest is. Senator Steve Daines of Montana, thanks. We do a simulcast on FBN in a moment.
Now, the Brian Kilmeade Show joins Fox Business's Varney & Company with Stuart Varney, live on your radio and on Fox Business. Here's Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Welcome back. We're going to go on with Stuart Varney shortly, and at the tail end, I'll be able to get to the phone calls around the country, 1-866-408-7669. So we have Pam Bondi testifying in Capitol Hill. She's getting grilled by Amy Klobuchar, as well as of going at it with Senator Dick Durbin about Chicago and everything else. It is explosive. You forget that the Senate's in business. The House went home. They passed a continuing resolution, but they didn't go. And so they really have nothing to do, so we sent them home. So let's listen.
Brian, I just want to read to you what we got from Zorhan Mandami this morning.
It's a statement from her. I'm sure you've seen it, but yep. I want our viewers to see it again. I'm reading it. 2 years ago today, Hamas carried out a horrific war crime, killing more than 1,100 Israelis. I mourn these lives and pray for the safe return of every hostage. In the aftermath of that day, Prime Minister Netanyahu and the Israeli government launched a genocidal war, a death toll that now far exceeds 67,000, with the Israeli military bombing homes, hospitals and schools into rubble. This must end. The occupation and apartheid must end. That, in my opinion, Brian, is a disgrace. He describes Israel as a genocidal state, and that's just plain wrong. Well, have at it.
That's what New Yorkers want to elect. I mean, he's not hiding it. This is him modulating his views until he gets the job. So that's how he feels. The genocide, that's how he characterizes it. So I understand. So in Mondami's world of Uganda, I guess, born and then raised over here, and for 33 years old, he was an assemblyman. But in his world, when you get attacked and over 1,000 people get killed arbitrarily, mostly civilians, and 200 plus are taken hostage, he should decide what the retribution should be while they still hold people against their will. So you decide. After 9/11, will we give it a threshold by the world on how many people we should take out in order to make sure Al-Qaeda doesn't try that again? How many terrorists we killed along the way? And sadly, there might have been some innocent people and collateral damage along the way. Never our intent, but it happens. Now you have somebody, according to experts at the War College over at West Point, who says they were fighting a more humanitarian war in Gaza per capita than even we were doing in Iraq with Fallujah and Ramadi. They go out of their way. The problem is where innocent people die. The problem is Hamas is intent on building their tunnels and their traps and their offices in hospitals, in schools, and in mosques. In fact, one of the hostages that thankfully got out is going to be joining us next hour. In his book, he says he was kept above ground for 50 days, and then they were brought to a mosque where a door opened up, and they went down a ladder into a tunnel. So if you want to know why innocent people might die, maybe it's because you built that where innocent people are. And we all know that nobody's profited more off the free aid given to that area than Hamas. The people that he obviously loves and worships, and I'm sure he would be one of those people protesting today all throughout Manhattan against Israel and for Hamas.
Yeah, disgraceful. But then again, let's have a look at the other candidate, New York City mayoral candidate Andrew Cuomo. Now, he was on The View. He downplayed the sex scandal that drove him from office. Watch this.
You left office apologizing to those women while always denying the most serious accusations. But you've taken a more combative stance lately.
I didn't even know who the individuals were. We then spent 5 years. That report went to five district attorneys all over the state. No one found anything. I did say if I offended anyone in any way, I didn't mean it. A painful lesson, which is to be much more cautious. I won't kiss a person on the cheek unless they initiate a kiss.
Okay, that's an explanation of his scandal. Do you think it works with voters?
No, and I don't think the reason he's not going to get elected, it doesn't look like it anyway, unless something dramatically happens, is because of the sex scandal. I just don't even think it's the way he ran the pandemic or with the horrible thing he did with the nursing homes. We're not going to get to that point. Bottom line is the majority of people, sadly, that choose to vote in New York City want an extreme socialist. That's what he's doing. The reason why he doesn't apologize to cops, the reason why he doesn't apologize to Israelis, to Jews, is because he's afraid of alienating the 400,000 people that voted for him and got him the victory in the primary. That's what we're dealing with. Governor Cuomo is not losing because of the way he left the governor's mansion. He is losing because, number one, he's lazy, barely even tried in the primary, now is kicking into gear. He thought it was going to be anointed to him. Number two is the era of traditional Democrats is over in the Northeast. It's done. And that's what he said yesterday. He says there's a civil war in the Democratic Party. And that's what's happening in real time. It's not Stuart Varney's opinion or my opinion. That's the opinion of people like Hakeem Jeffries and Schumer, who, like cowards, refuse to call out this socialist.
Yep. You're right. And Mandami is going to win. Brian Kilmeade, thanks for joining us. All good stuff. Thank you.
You got it. Thank you so much. And that's really what's going on. I mean, oftentimes you talk about these issues in New York. We're lucky enough to be carried by WABC in New York, but this is a national issue. Why? Because there's a lot of Mandami lights running across the country, and they feel as though the young people have given up on capitalism and will be open to socialism because they don't like the current system the way it is right now. And his statement is so abhorrent. He spends three lines saying what happened on October 7th is terrible, and the rest of the time talking about how Netanyahu is presiding over genocide. Hey, look, Europe feels that way. You have the prime minister of that left-wing prime minister of the UK feels the same way. Macron basically said the same thing, trying to recognize a Palestinian state that you can't possibly draw on a map. It doesn't exist. So that's what's happening. Just a quick note. If you really want to care about our country, go back in history as we come up in the year 250. I'm on stage with a show I think you'll really love, History, Liberty, and Laughs. It's streamed on Fox Nation. My next stop is Pottstown, Pennsylvania. Go to BrianKilmeade.com for tickets. And, of course, you could stream it and you get specials when you get there. And that's great. Meanwhile, special thanks to Steve Daines for joining us this hour, as well as Douglas Murray. And always keep it here. This is an important day, October 7th, 2 years to the day in which the most horrific crime that I can remember in modern history was perpetrated on the Israelis, many of which were sympathetic toward the Palestinian cause. I don't see how they can now. Don't move.
News headquarters in New York City. Always seeking solutions, never sowing division. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, I'm Brian Kilmeade. Welcome to the latest moments of the Brian Kilmeade Show here on October 7th, 2 years to the day of the most horrific attacks that I can remember in my lifetime, and the certainly second most horrific attacks maybe on the Jewish people and, of course, in the country of Israel, who's been on a war footing ever since, neutralizing the Houthi rebels. Absolutely destroying but not eliminating Hezbollah and setting back, if not destroying, the Iranian nuclear program with our help. And we are one of the few democracies still standing firmly in their corner. Sadly, it says a lot about our allies as we look back on October 7th. It also says the state of American politics, especially in New York City, where we're looking at multiple protests for people for Hamas and don't like the fact that Israel fought back after over 1,000 people lost their lives and hundreds were taken hostage, one of which joins me in studio, Eli Sharabi. Eli was held hostage for 491 days in Gaza, author of a memoir you simply have to get called Hostage. Eli, welcome to the show. It was nice seeing you on Fox and Friends yesterday, and I'm glad you're okay today.
Thank you very much. It's my big honor to be here.
When did you realize it would be important for you to write this book?
I think after my visit in the UN and my testimony there, people approached me and said, I have to write all this down and that all the world will know my story.
Your brother lost his life. His body is still being held in captivity. Your wife and your daughters were killed and you're taken hostage. How do you put in perspective what you've been forced to experience through no fault of your own?
Well, you know, it was a hell of a time in all this 491 days, October 7, as we experienced that. And after that, the captivity and all the announcement after that about Yossi, my brother, and of course, my wife and my daughter just after my release and understood they had been slaughtered.
Did you know that when you were taken?
No, they were fine. They were all calm, very calm in our house. We were sure the British passports will protect them. But probably these animals doesn't have any boundaries, and they killed them, murdered them 5 minutes after I was kidnapped.
So how old were they, 16 and 13?
16 and 13, Noya in the hell, yes.
So, and you said you could still remember the terror that they felt when you were being taken.
Wow, just to see their fears in their eyes, I can't forget this this fear, this this look. And I promised myself the day I was going to be released, I'm going to take Leanne, Noya, and Dihel out of this conflict area and going back to London.
And sadly, you didn't have that point. But going through your captivity, thinking that they were alive probably motivated you to get out. If you had known this, it probably would have been even harder for you to survive.
Yes, it's all me in life. You know, life. And thanks God, nobody told me differently. So it kept me alive just to survive for them and see them again. And I can hug them again. And I imagine the day of my release, thousands of times that they are going to run towards me and we can be together again.
Yeah. So now you want to tell your story. Do you fear, as I do, that so many people forgot about October 7th and they're focusing on Gaza and they don't focus on what happened that led to the attack on Gaza, a place that almost every Israeli said we have no interest in. We have no interest in going in. But after October 7th, you had no choice. You worried that people have lost perspective.
Yes. It's the main reason to write this testimony that nobody will forget, not October 7th, not what we, you know, all this time in the safe room waiting for the army, the brutality and the cruel that the terrorists, you know, show to the hostages. And, you know, on October 7th, I was more than 70 kilos and I was released less than 44 kilos.
And that's about 90 pounds?
Something like that.
How often did you eat?
We ate one meal a day in the last 6 months in captivity. We ate one meal a day, a bowl of pasta, 1.5 pita bread that was very, very dry. And they had lots of food. They had lots of food. They ate 4 or 5 times a day.
In front of you?
In front of us. We've seen the dozens of boxes every week getting in from the humanitarian aid. So they had enough food.
What does that make you think when people say the people are starving, the Israelis cut off aid, and yet you're seeing Hamas eat like kings?
Yes. This is them. They don't care about, especially not about us, but they don't care even their own population, the Palestinians, that everybody's shouting for them and all this. Hamas doesn't care about them.
What makes you think that?
Well, we've seen they stole from them their humanitarian aid. And they said to us, they're upstairs, they're starving, and they're waiting for their food. And in the meantime, we see them eating 5 times a day.
Do you think do you disseminate between the Palestinian people and Hamas?
Sorry, again?
Is there a difference in your view of the Palestinian people and Hamas?
Well, I don't know, but the Palestinian people, when civilians, when we call, and people want to identify them as uninvolved, all the people I've seen trying to lynch me, even Hamas terrorists was afraid that somebody will recognize that there are Israelis in this house or in the tunnels, and they will come in and kill them as well.
So to be clear, so Hamas is actually protecting you from the Palestinian people. If
yes.
They knew there was a hostage there, they would just overpower Hamas, grab you, and kill you.
They said that all the time. They were scared about that. Well, the first stop in Gaza, they took me away from the the guardians of Hamas terrorists and start to lynch me. It was kids on top of me, start to hit me with their shoes. So, yes, I can't say they're uninvolved.
How hard was it on you physically? Were you beaten? Were you... starved?
Well, we were humiliated daily basis. We were chained 24/7 for 485 days. Just a week before my release, they took it off. We were beaten from time to time. They undressed us almost every 2 weeks and search on our body and look for things, I don't know what. And of course, the starvation was the worst thing.
Where did they keep you? Do you know? Did they keep you?
I was in central of Gaza. I was in Nusrat. But I think most of the hostages are there in the central of Gaza. And it's a place that the IDF is being very, very careful not to attack.
So you think the IDF knows roughly where these hostages are?
Yes.
Right? And are most of them in and around Gaza City?
Most of them. Most of them.
In tunnels?
Yes, of course.
So you were kept above ground for a while, though, right?
Only the first 52 days. I've been in Palestinians' family's house. The family were in the first floor. We've been in the second floor. That's it.
And how did you get down? Through a mosque? There was a door in a mosque that got you? You went downstairs? How did they get you into the tunnel?
Oh, they just... We went to... One day they let us know that we are leaving the house. So we walked 20 minutes through the first mosque we've seen. We got in and took us to a side room and opened this door.
In a mosque?
Yes.
So what does it tell you? As you know, people should understand this. They put the entrance to these tunnels in mosques and schools and in hospitals.
Yes, exactly.
Because they think that, well, if the Israelis bomb this, they'll look like the bad guys.
Yes. The first, well, we got in from a mosque and we went out from a school. And this is the second tunnel we've been. We're underground of a hospital. So, yes. This is the place that they're digging their tunnels because they know the IDF will be very, very careful not to bomb there.
So you worry especially about another captive that you left behind, a 24-year-old Alon Ohai, right?
Alon Ohai was with me, yes.
So tell me about him.
Oh, great kid. Great kid, very naive and, you know, frightened for his life. Very talented pianist, amazing guy. With great values, his parents raised him very, very well. And I think after an hour of talking with him, we found so many in common between us. And so I just adopted him like a father for him, yes.
So, and he kind of leaned on you, and then you had to tell him at one point, or it became clear that you were getting out and he wasn't. How tough was that?
Well, it was very tough. It was maybe one of the toughest moments I've been there. We hugged each other. We cried. We said to each other that I'm sure he can survive without me. He did a lot, you know, to understand what he need to survive. So,
were you able to talk to his family?
Yeah, all the time. One of the first calls, I've done two calls in the same day of I was released. One was to Leanne, my wife's parents, to England. That was very hard conversation. And the second one was to Alon's parents to tell them that their kids is fine, he can survive. And they have to have all the faith in the world that they will see him one day.
And we understand he's still alive, right?
He is still alive. Well, last time I've seen him, it was months ago in this video. I was very happy to see that. And I'm quite sure I will see him soon.
Eli Sharabi is here. His book is now out. It talks about what he was living through in his 491 days as a hostage. And this is marking the second year since the October 7th attacks. Why do you think you were chosen to be released?
Well, they said to me it's because of my age.
How old are you?
I'm 53 years old. So back then I was 52, almost 53. And they said, the old one was coming now out and next will be the youngs. And we were sure it will be in a week. I promised that to Alon, that I'll fight for him and he will be soon home. And unfortunately, sadly, is already there 240 days more than since the day of my release.
We're going to have a few more minutes with Eli. Eli, go grab his book, tell the true story, and get people a perspective on what this year does, what happened on October 7th, and not forget it, to have a perspective on why Israel is even forced to fight in Gaza to begin with. You're listening to the Brian Kilmeade Show. Don't move.
The talk show that's getting you talking. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Central to this has always been in the past Hamas. And what they are pushing back on, they're saying they're willing to give up the hostages, but then they're also saying, well, we don't have complete control of them. Other groups have some of the hostages from the very outset.
In fact, true. Why don't we ask former hostage who has a book called Hostage out today, Eli Sharabi. He was held there for 491 days in Gaza, and he put together his personal account. He lost his children. He lost his wife in this attack. He lost his brother, whose body is still being held in Gaza. But he wants to tell the story so people don't forget, marking the second year since those attacks in 2023. Eli, what do you think about what General Keane just said? Hamas says, we don't really have track of all the hostages.
I hope they are not saying the truth. I think they said they're going to release all the, they agreed to release all the hostages, and they cannot say that if they don't know where's everybody.
Do you think they do know? Was there an organization? I'm
quite sure they do know. They have control about everything in Gaza. I hope it will not have be a problem with that. Otherwise, probably the finish or the agreement will not be accepted.
So you said that these guys never expected this type of response from Israel, and that they cry themselves, they're crying and have panic attacks because they know the next day could be their last?
Yes. They were sure this war after October 7, 23, it will finish in a month or two. They came to us and asked us why it's continue, why Netanyahu wants to kill them, why he doesn't let them to be in the government anymore. You know, they've been they used to cry to their pillows at night, try to do it quietly, but we heard them very good, and have panic attacks from time to time, shaking, fainting. Their situation wasn't very good. They counted their friends, their fighters, their terrorists with them. Every day they count something like 100 of them that have been killed with the with this confrontation with the Israelis.
Do you believe the numbers that 67,000 are dead?
Maybe, I don't know, but probably most of them are not uninvolved.
I want you to hear what this mayoral candidate, Zoran Mamdani, said about October 7th. 2 years ago, Hamas carried out a horrific attack, killing more than 1,100 Israelis, kidnapping 250. I mourn these lives and pray for their safe return. In the aftermath, Prime Minister Netanyahu and the Israeli government launched a genocidal war, a death toll that exceeds 67,000, with the Israeli military bombing hospitals and schools into rubble. Every day in Gaza has become a place of grief, instead has run out of language. I mourn these lives and pray for their families. This must end. The occupation and apartheid must end. Peace must be pursued through diplomacy, not war crimes, and our government must act to end these atrocities. Do you agree with his description?
Not at all. I'm not going to argue with him, but if you can tell me how you can fight with terrorists that hiding behind his own population, and running with kids alongside them, that the IDF will not bomb them. How can you fight with them without people to get hurt? And the genocide was on October 7th. That didn't come from Hamas.
And Eli, what sustains you today with these horrible images fresh in your mind and still no end to this conflict, even though we hope it's close? What sustains you today? What drives you?
I mean,
what's your motivation now? What motivates you now?
My motivation that the hostages will come back. These people cannot, you cannot hear their voice, so I'm their voice. And for their families, 48 still there. 48 hostages remained in Gaza Strip, held by Hamas. Their families' life, you know, it's not the same anymore. We need to bring them back home and start to healing our trauma.
And if people want to understand what truly happened, pick up Eli's book. If you want to support somebody who's keeping the cause alive, it's called Hostage. Eli Sharabi, so glad you're okay, and hopefully we have good news soon.
Thank you very much. I hope so.
Thanks for telling your story.
He's so busy, he'll make your head spin. It's Brian Kilmeade.
All right, we are back, and we're continuing to monitor everything with Pam Bondi on Capitol Hill taking fire about personnel changes, about different things with Letitia James, talking about the Epstein files, everything front and center, because the Senate's still at work. The House went home because we're in the middle of a shutdown, and so we'll see what's going on. The worst thing to come out of the shutdown so far is, even though it's 6 days in, air traffic controllers evidently in Burbank, none showed up. They're beginning to thin out over in Newark. There were delays in Denver and Los Angeles. So that, if you're really disrupting people's travel, I'm not sure why you can't go 6 days and you're not even missing a paycheck and not showing up. We're also following all the goings on. Republicans are all over the fact that Jack Smith evidently had a list of Republican senators that he was monitoring their communications and related to the Donald Trump investigations prior to the election, which have now been dissipated. So let's bring in Howie Kurtz, Fox News political analyst. Howie, how would you characterize who's winning the shutdown wars right now?
Well, there's no question that Donald Trump has the bigger megaphone, and it's very hard for people like Hakeem Jeffries to compete with that, and Chuck Schumer. But I would say that the Democrats have scored, surprisingly, in my view, in getting across the notion that they're, fighting for health care. Marjorie Taylor Greene has complained, and she's broken with the White House on this, that her adult children will find their premiums doubled if certain Obamacare credits, tax credits, aren't extended. But look, when it reaches the level of some of these airports can barely function, I mean, that's pretty scary. And it also just shows, you know, ultimately, spoiler alert, what's going to happen is the Democrats will cave, and then Republicans will say, oh, we'll talk to you about your concerns, and then they'll do whatever they want.
Yeah, I mean, a little of those things is whatever those premiums are, it was because this rescue plan came in with the pandemic and they raised the amount of people eligible 400% above the poverty line. They also put in tax credits to allow people on health to get those tax credit when it comes to health care. So the premiums are up. The question is, they were down. They were artificially put down. And are we going to continue to fund at pandemic levels? Is that indeed possible? The big, beautiful bill took care of that. Here's what Mike Johnson said, the speaker, cut 36.
Thanks to the DOGE effort, okay, when Elon came in and got the team working, they were putting the magic algorithms to work through all these agencies. We've done oversight. We've had hearings since I've been here for 8 years. We tried to dug into this. They didn't show us those facts, but they were able to uncover it because the facts don't lie. And then we unwound it. We, of course, clawed it back. We made sure that in the one big, beautiful bill and in the codifying of the executive orders, we got rid of that stuff. The Democrats want it back. That's the point. That's what Senator Kennedy was saying there with his charts on the Senate floor just a couple days ago. He's pointing out that Chuck Schumer is making a demand in exchange for opening the government. He wants to spend $1.5 trillion additional dollars, and he wants all that absurdity back in the budget. We're not doing that. Republicans have drawn a line. We're going to return to sanity here, and we can't let Chuck Schumer and the Democrats prevail.
And how you want to message that and what they're going to do in the interim and how much pressure is on Chuck Schumer not to cave?
Well, I think he needed, he's not exactly the world's most exciting speaker, I will put it diplomatically. You could doze off watching him read stuff off note cards. But I think the Democrats are the party of government. It hurts them. The Republicans used to be against it. But, you know, Mike Johnson also said he doesn't like the fact in his state of Louisiana that FEMA grants have been cut, that, you know, he acknowledged the health care problem. So the problem is suddenly Republicans are like these federal budget things, even though it comes out of their budget. I mean, this is the budget that they proposed. And now, look, I mean, the hypocrisy is on both sides, depending on who controls the White House. Mm-hmm. And it can't go on forever. I mean, I've been through so many of these. I remember the Clinton administration had, I think, the longest one, but more pain that's felt by more people in more localities. And I think the pressure will be enormous to at least kick the can down the road, which is their Congress's specialty, for a few more weeks.
So, Howie, you know I'm busy in the morning, so I don't get a chance to watch the Today Show. And I know you don't either because you're always watching Fox and Friends. But I want you, I want to bring you to an exchange with their anchor and Hakeem Jeffries, because I'm just surprised by where they brought him. Cut 33.
So, Mr. Leader, again, longest shutdown was during the first Trump presidency. This is what you said at the time about that particular shutdown. Here it is.
We are willing to take what Senate Republicans have done in order to reopen the government so that we no longer are holding 800,000 federal workers hostage.
Well, that's exactly what you're doing right now. Hundreds of thousands of workers are being held hostage. What's changed from then to now?
Well, actually, Donald Trump is a president. Republicans control the House, the Senate, and the presidency. They could reopen the government if they chose to. The reality
is... Well, they would have to change the rules, to be
fair.
Well,
that's correct, but which they've done multiple times.
So he's saying, change the filibuster rule? That's not my fault? So we kind of boxed him in there. I bet you he was surprised.
Here inside the Beltway, that is called not a very effective defense, to use a sports analogy. But you know, it's not just Mike Johnson. A lot of Marjorie Taylor Greene, for example, says that, you know, her own children, her adult children, their premiums are going to double if these tax credits are not extended. So, you know, on the one hand, Johnson and many of his fellow Republicans are suddenly being very sensitive to the fact that local hospitals, local nursing homes, whatever, are being affected. On the other hand, this is the budget they pushed through, including a decline in what we used to call food stamps, nursing assistance, and so forth. So it's a mess. It's getting worse. Nobody seems to want to compromise. But an informal deadline may be when members of the military, who right now are fighting without pay, when they would miss their first paycheck. You know, a lot of people, Brian, live paycheck to paycheck, and this is going to be tough on them.
Most Americans. So I want to bring you to Jon Stewart last night on The Daily Show. You always see who's out of favor with the Democratic Party when The Daily Show or the Tonight, not The Tonight Show, but more Colbert and Kimmel take shots at Democrats. There's usually a reason. Here we go. Listen to this.
New data came out today from KFF, and that is not Kentucky Fried French Fries. KFF could be Kentucky French fries. I know. Aren't.
Who is that joke even for? 6-year-olds that watch C-SPAN? What the f*** are you doing? Chuck Schumer is a human flat tire.
And it got worse. And he really roasted him a little bit before that and after that. I mean, that's using comedy to do what a lot of other people are saying behind the scenes, that he's not an effective leader.
Yeah, I think Jon Stewart, you know, who we have to give credit for helping to push that bill through to help veterans who developed Agent Orange and so forth. I think that Stewart's saying Chuck Schumer, flat tire. He really it's painful watching him. And I think also Jon Stewart. Sure, Chuck is out of favor, no question about it. I mean, he symbolizes the establishment, which is so popular these days, Brian. But I think that he wants to show once in a while that he doesn't only attack Republicans. Mm-hmm. Schumer's a fat target.
So I want to read something within the media world. CBS News employees received a note that it looks like the CEO from David Ellison announcing the acquisition of the Free Press and the appointment of Barry Weiss, the CBS News editor-in-chief. She said, quote, "I'm confident that in the coming years, CBS News and the Free Press will make big strides and be at the forefront of the much-needed transformation in how news is gathered, reported, and delivered." So how will things change there? I enjoy listening to and reading the Free Press. I think she does a great job as a broadcaster. Mm-hmm. She clearly is a great writer. So, and they describe the Free Press as conservative leaning. I never considered it conservative leaning, but they describe it that way. What changes at CBS? What do you project it'll be like?
Well, first of all, these liberal idiots who are attacking her as incompetent and so forth, I didn't notice they creating something from scratch and selling it for $100 million. There's a little bit of jealousy here in my view. But secondly, I mean, CBS is a huge organization. And she will have a learning curve. She's going to suddenly have, 500 new assistants. And I wrote a column today defending her because I interviewed her this year. And she said, I said, "How did you get to the New York Times?" She said, "Howie, I was a diversity hire." And she acknowledged to me that she sobbed at her desk when Trump won in 2016. But turns out she liked some of his first, not all, but some of his first term policies. So I think the Free Press, they did an incredible job with it. That's going to remain independent. But look, it's going to be a while before you can turn CBS News around. There's a lot of resentment toward her, which is unfair. The people who are criticizing her, they're not really familiar with what she does. They just repeat the same misinformation BS.
Yeah, I think things could go in the right direction. I think that she's somebody to me who's just open, who gets up every day and judges Trump like a president. Oh, I don't like this policy. I like this policy. Rather than getting up every day, he shouldn't be there. He's not worthy of the office. Unhinged. He treats him more like Bush or Clinton type, kind of a throwback. So we'll judge it. So I find the whole thing really interesting that they would make that type of dramatic move. But that's interesting that Paramount did not like the status quo.
She's been on the job one day. So where are the changes? I'm kidding. Because, getting attacked the way she has, unfairly slimed, in my view, before you let her be there a month and we'll see. I mean, she's now going to be in charge of 60 Minutes, CBS Mornings, CBS Sunday Morning, you name it. She's very smart, very talented. And her podcast guests have ranged from Marco Rubio to Andrew Cuomo to Woody Allen. And she gave Woody Allen a hard time in that 98-minute interview.
And lastly, Governor Cuomo was on trying to be Mayor Cuomo on The View yesterday. And one of the lines that stuck out with me is when he said, "The Democratic Party's in the middle of a civil war right now. You have me, who's a regular Democrat, and then you have the socialist wing. And that's really what I'm fighting against." I agree with Governor Cuomo. Do you?
I think it was smart of him to go on The View. He did get pressed about the sexual harassment allegations, which he retreats to his standard language about, "Well, if anyone is offended, I feel bad about that, and I won't try to kiss somebody unless they initiate it." So that did come up. But look, this is all about stopping Mamdani, who kicked Cuomo's ass in the primary. He's the Democratic nominee. And even though Eric Adams has dropped out, I think even in a one-on-one, I think Mamdani, a lot of people are uncomfortable with his self-declared socialist policies, government-run grocery stores and all of that. But I think he's on track to win. I don't think Cuomo's close enough, but certainly he has a lot more experience than an assemblyman from Queens. Well, they're both from Queens, actually.
One thing about Cuomo, he does have experience. You can't fault that. Eric Adams is out, and Curtis Lee was still in double digits, a solid third. But you have to, so if he would drop out, the theory would be Republicans would go to Cuomo. We'll have to see. He's got such a troubled past. Interesting times. Howie Kurtz, thanks so much. Always appreciate it.
Great to see you, Brian.
You got it. And Howie, how do you get your podcast?
You go wherever your podcasts are sold. Podcast is a good place to get it because you don't have to listen to the ads.
You got it. Back in a moment.
Don't go anywhere. Brian Kilmeade will be right back. Information you want. Truth you demand. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show. Sponsored by Prevagen. Prevagen, made for your brain.
I know that you did his podcast, New Heights, which, by the way, I have done. And since I've done his podcast, they've won every game.
Yeah, you know what? Don't think I didn't notice that.
Thank you.
Yeah, so
I don't want to thank you, and I don't want any credit. Let's not act like it didn't happen.
Let's not jinx anything. But it did happen.
It did happen.
We have to acknowledge certain superstitious, you know, things that cause a streak of winning.
Now Lawrence goes down, has to get up, breaks a tackle, touchdown, Jacksonville.
There goes the streak. Jaguars beat the Kansas City Chiefs with 30 seconds left. Trevor Lawrence falls down on his own, gets up, and then runs in the end zone after an interference call. And the Chiefs have lost again. And that was Taylor Swift on the Tonight Show yesterday to announce a new album, which is stunningly successful. I have not listened to it. I probably will have to run into it because it's played on every cut. I have nothing against her at all. But I do notice that the Kansas City Chiefs have, you know, they got a tough schedule, but they're not doing well this year. And another great team, the Ravens, not doing well this year. But you can't blame Taylor Swift. She's not even on camera. She's moved away from the camera. She's not even a distraction. So I think that was intentional. After she got engaged, you see her pushing back. The one thing I've not done, by the way, just announcing the Canadian leader has met with the president. They're meeting outside the White House, I think, to finalize a trade agreement. His second visit to the White House since becoming prime minister. We'll follow that. The one thing I do want to talk about before we leave is what's happening in Portland, what's happening in Chicago. A judge stopped a National Guard from going into Portland, and I find that sickening because nobody else is helping out. Our ICE officials, our ATF, our Border Patrol, they're being attacked constantly by these protesters. But what's really getting me now, Texas National Guard, it's on its way to help out it in the second city in Chicago, because we have a mayor that says the president's going after black and brown people and basically says do not cooperate. And we have transmission over the radio of cops being told don't help out ICE officials. So I'm just astounded that we've gotten to this point that now you have to call in the National Guard to help out cops instead of cops helping cops. Here is Caroline Levitt yesterday, cut 26.
Ultimately, in the case in Los Angeles, that judge ruled in the Ninth Circuit, that panel of judges ruled that those troops could remain and that the president was well within his authority to do so. So we are appealing that decision. As you know, we expect a hearing on it pretty quickly. And we're very confident in the president's legal authority to do this. And we're very confident we will win on the merits of the law.
So that means the National Guard will go in. The hope is when you bring in some federal forces, whether you like it or not, the message will be crack down on crime while Trump's coming back, to help out the citizens. Also, a known gang member of the Latin Kings, whatever you are rising up in the Latin King gang community, I'm not familiar enough with them. This guy personally put bounties on the heads of people on the ICE officials saying 2,000 a hurt, 10,000 a kill. They caught him. They arrested him. That is the type of people that are causing havoc in Chicago. All the president wants to do is protect them. And all the mayor and governor want to do is help out their political fortunes. Same thing in Portland, Oregon. Hope people can see through all that. One's trying to fight crime and one's trying to support it. You listen to the Brian Kilmeade Show.